IAEA must be preserved. The inspection work of the IAEA should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip.
Iran has warned of countermeasures if the board passes the resolution and says it's cooperating with the agency over questions about the presence of uranium particles at two undeclared sites. Grossi reiterated the IAEA would remain impartial, avoid judging intentions or issuing condemnations.
The work and the trust must always exist. And when we have doubts, we ask questions. We are not condemning anybody.
It's still unclear if the board will adopt the Western-backed resolution, but Russia has already made it clear it will oppose it. In a note to other board members, Russia warned the adoption of the resolution would hugely complicate efforts to revive the nuclear deal and undermine normal cooperation between Iran and the agency. Homolezgi Fiena.
Among other things, the past year felt like a long one, featuring several announcements from British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, from massive spending to protect jobs.
Today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help.
To the so-called Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and to what's known as the stamp duty holiday to help homebuyers. Since he was unexpectedly made Chancellor in February last year, Mr. Sunak has only made one formal fiscal statement. But on the 3rd of March, the young Chancellor will unveil his very difficult second budget, originally expected November last year, but postponed because of the uncertainty created by the raging pandemic and the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. But has that fog of uncertainty cleared now that they have a Brexit deal?
The biggest trade deal yet.
Well, and the vaccination program is at full blast. Not exactly. The pandemic is still very much here, meaning serious restrictions will remain in place till at least midsummer. So given that lingering uncertainty, what does the UK public anticipate from Mr. Sunak's announcement? One expectation is an extension to the £20 a week increase in the government handout to the poor, benefiting some 6 million families due to end in March.
A lot of people I know who actually sort of, that is all they're earning at the moment. It's literally their less than £400 a month. Yeah, it's definitely, it's vital for them.
People are on it for a reason, you know. I know a nurse who's working 5 days a week and still has to be on universal credit.
There will probably also be an extension of the furlough scheme due to end in April. The UK's jobless rate rose to over 5% in the 3 months to December, leaving unemployment at 1.7 million.
It's hard to think that you're going to be able to find a lot of jobs for people right now, but they're coming back at some point, hopefully. But in the meantime, I mean, people have to get by somehow. People need money to buy food. People need money to just survive.
There are lots of people all over the country who don't have any income or have significantly reduced income because of the pandemic and the crisis.
Also expected, an extension of the various tax breaks, help to educate children whose schooling has been so badly disrupted, or for the health service to cope with its long backlog of non-COVID waiting lists. And then there's the question of tax rises. The Chancellor has dropped many hints that tax rises are inevitable. Hikes in corporation tax, capital gains tax, carbon pollution taxes, and a new online sales levy are all under consideration.
Economists are unanimously warning the Chancellor to hold off imposing any new tax hikes, saying they will merely damage the economy. But will he heed that advice? And how will it impact the lives of millions of people around the country if he chooses to ignore it? Saeed Puriza, London.
Prisoners' rights activists and families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners and demanded an end to Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. Some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers.
Israel has demonstrated zero accountability and acts with impunity because it enjoys the full support of the United States. Israel considers itself as an entity that is above international law. Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the Palestinian people, especially against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as around 400 of them are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Palestinian prisoners are suffering because of medical negligence as well as administrative detention in Israeli prisons, and their situation became much worse during the coronavirus pandemic. We call on international organizations to exert real pressure on Israel in order to stop its illegal and inhumane practices against Palestinian prisoners.
Many Palestinian prisoners also suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons. Dozens of prisoners suffer from cancer and other life-threatening diseases.
The suffering of Palestinian inmates in Israeli prisons is unprecedented. They're being oppressed on a daily basis, and the Israeli regime is systematically killing the prisoners by denying them proper medical care. We're here today to let the whole world know that we're standing with the prisoners.
Palestinian inmates are more vulnerable now with the absence of vital preventive measures during the coronavirus pandemic.
Experts say that the protection Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to continue to violate the rights of Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Iran's defense ministry has delivered 9 military and transportation planes, 10 choppers, and tens of engines repaired at Iran Aviation Industries Organization to the Iranian Armed Forces. Iranian specialists have overhauled 9 jet fighters, including F-4, F-14, F-27, and Mirage types, as well as transportation types of planes, including C-130, 707, and 747. The types of the 10 overhauled helicopters range from 204 and 205 to 212 and 214, which have applications in combat and rescue operations. The engines overhauled include turbojet, turbofan, and turboshaft types.
The enemy was in vain efforts to defeat Iran through sanctions and restrictions on buying military equipment, but the country conquered the enemy by reliance on indigenous capability, building military equipment, and optimizing defense equipment. Iran's successful strategy has defeated the enemy's maximum pressure policy.
Iran has utilized capacities of domestic knowledge-based companies in overhauling and repairing the helicopters and planes.
The Air Force of the Islamic Republic of Iran is a dynamic, innovative, and self-sufficient sector, which is completely reliable for operational purposes. The delivery of several planes and helicopters to the force indicates the creativity of our experts with which we have optimized and upgraded our equipment. We will defend our country's borders under all conditions in the best way.
In recent years, Iran has made great strides in the defense sector and become self-sufficient in producing essential military hardware and defense systems. Iran has repeatedly made it clear that its military might is merely defensive and that it poses no threat to other countries.
Iran says at the time of sanctions, overhauling light, semi-heavy, and heavy military equipment is the most cost-effective and safest way to boost the country's defensive capabilities. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
One year has passed from a meeting in the Qatari capital, Doha, where the US and Taliban representatives inked a deal to put an end to the decades-long misery of the Afghan nation by reaching an agreement to bring peace to the war-ravaged country. The release of 5,000 Taliban inmates, the withdrawal of foreign troops, and the Taliban's approval of a ceasefire were the main parts of the US-Taliban deal. The prisoners were released, but the other two commitments have not been fulfilled yet. Soon after the US-Taliban deal was signed, the first round of intra-Afghan talks kicked off in Doha. This once again ruined the dreams of Afghans as it failed to bring peace. Now, Afghan officials not only warn the Taliban to either approve a lasting peace or get ready to be killed by Afghan armed troops, but blamed the international community for depriving Afghans of their fundamental right, that is peace.
The international community has deprived a great nation, which has a great history and bright civilization, of one of their fundamental rights, that is peace. This is unacceptable. We want a lasting peace that should be achieved via our armed troops' power and will of the nation.
The Afghan peace process is facing some key obstacles, including foreign interference. But the bitter fact is that the main victims of war are innocent civilians. Based on an annual report by Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission on humanitarian conditions for Afghan children, nearly 6,000 civilians, including more than 2,000 children, were killed in 2020 due to war and violence in Afghanistan.
The total number of civilian casualties recorded by Independent Human Rights Commission over the last year is 5,800. 2,019 of them are children. That is why we want all warring sides to pay respect to civilian lives.
Let's not forget that the new U.S. administration has announced Washington is going to review the U.S. Taliban deal. The declaration was welcomed by the Afghan government, but the Taliban urgently reacted and blamed the U.S. for seeking a pretext to stay in Afghanistan further. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela might be about to break relations with the Kingdom of Spain after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced he would review relations of all kinds with the European country due to what he calls their improper and disrespectful actions against Venezuela. Experts say that Spain, among members of the European Union, is regarded as the most important influence in the European policy toward the nations of Latin America. In the light of rising political tensions between Caracas and Madrid, Maduro denounced recent hostile actions from the Spanish government of Pedro Sanchez, including the Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha Gonzalez, who last Saturday visited the border between Colombia and Venezuela and criticized the situation of Venezuelan migrants in the zone. The visit by the top Spaniard diplomat in Colombia was strongly decried by Maduro, saying that Spain must stay away from his country's internal issues.
I condemn Spain's meddling actions. Such a mistaken conduct will be punished by my administration.
Meanwhile, on the opposition side, many backed the Spanish move, alleging the European country must intervene in Venezuela's problems.
Spain's speaking in favor of Venezuelan migrants who flee our homeland due to Maduro's failed regime.
However, Venezuelan officials insist the Spanish move is politically motivated and therefore will not be tolerated.
Spain and the European Union must rectify their hostile political stance on Venezuela, or else relations will break up.
Maduro has remarked that relations with Spain in all areas will be fully examined by him, as the Spanish meddling in Venezuela's affairs is unacceptable. He blames Madrid over imitating the U.S. hostility and claims Venezuela will respond accordingly.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Despite taking promising first steps toward transparency, said Anna Diakon, staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, the Biden administration hasn't yet unveiled any broader plan to make good on its commitment to open government. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Biden Criticized for Lack of Transparency After Refusing to Publicize Virtual Visitor Logs. Stay tuned for more. While U.S. President Joe Biden has been less secretive than his immediate predecessor, watchdog groups unimpressed by the president's ability to clear the low ethical bar set by former President Donald Trump and frustrated by the White House's refusal to release virtual visitor logs despite the ongoing need for online meetings are criticizing the current administration for its lack of openness and urging Biden to prioritize government transparency. Emphasizing that Biden has fallen short of his previous boss, former President Barack Obama, when it comes to bringing transparency back to the White House, Politico reported recently that the White House has committed to releasing visitor logs, but it doesn't plan to divulge the names of attendees of virtual meetings, which are the primary mode of interaction until the coronavirus pandemic eases. We are in a pandemic, said Walter Shrub, former director of the U.S. Office of Government Ethics and now a senior ethics fellow at the Project on Government Oversight and Anti-Corruption Nonprofit. People meet by video conference instead of in person. Why offer to release visitor logs and then keep virtual meetings secret? He added. Politico noted that critics who want Biden to do more to restore confidence in the federal government following Trump's chaotic term also cited his administration's failure to share the president's and vice president's schedules online, to reinstate the White House comment line, and to allow for citizen petitions on the White House website. And while Biden has received kudos for keeping the American public informed, primarily by resuming the daily White House press briefings, has yet told a news conference of his own, Politico added. Alex Howard, director of the Digital Democracy Project at the left-leaning Demand Progress Educational Fund, told Politico that the steps taken by the Biden administration are insufficient to the moment and the need. Howard advocated opening cabinet meetings, disclosing information, and using political capital to emphasize that being open by default isn't just an option, but an obligation across the government. As Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CRU, tweeted, being more transparent than Trump, the president who refused to release his tax returns, is a very low bar. Biden should go even farther to ensure that Trump's standard is not the new normal. In the interest of promoting good government, dozens of civil society organizations having recently sent letters to the White House that questioned existing practices and pushed for policy changes are now insisting that Biden address the weakness in transparency laws that his predecessor exposed during his time in office. As the news outlet noted, that includes answering public records requests more quickly, publishing Office of Legal Counsel opinions, revising classification policies, and releasing logs of virtual meetings and physical meetings at other locations where the president and his aides travel. According to Shob, we have now learned the system was too weak, and we've been through 4 years of having to battle tooth and nail to get any documents that we need Biden to set up new system so the next administration will follow them. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki announced before Inauguration Day that the White House would bring back the release of its visitor logs, a practice started by Obama 8 months into his presidency, when the administration would regularly release and archive visitor logs for its core offices, with exceptions, Politico reported. Trump discontinued the practice, though, after a lawsuit he agreed to allow monthly publication of visitor logs for some White House offices, including the Office of Management and Budget. When Biden pledged to bring the logs back, it was seen as a reversion to the Obama norm, the news outlet noted. But COVID changed the basic concept of White House visitation and has altered expectations around what should be revealed. An unnamed White House official confirmed the Biden administration would not release virtual logs, telling Politico, virtual meetings will not be subject to release, in the same way that previous administration didn't release phone logs, but we are planning on regularly releasing the attendee list for in-person meetings at the White House. Not everybody is buying the White House's comparison of virtual meetings to phone calls, given how virtual meetings have, for public health reasons, become a stand-in for in-person meetings. One of the skeptics who thinks Biden should publicize the virtual logs is Norm Eisen, who served as Obama's ethics czar from 2009 to 2011. Eisen, now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, recently edited a report urging Biden take steps to rebuild faith in U.S. democracy in the wake of Trump's norm-shattering presidency. For the COVID era, when so much is being done remotely, he said there should be an accommodation for that. In addition, Biden has come under fire for his failure to restore the We the People pledge on the White House website, which was a popular citizen petition tool launched by Obama and discontinued under Trump. He has also been criticized for not restarting the White House comment line, an alternative to the website frequently used by senior citizens. Despite taking promising first steps toward transparency, said Anna Dykon, staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, the Biden administration hasn't yet unveiled any broader plan to make good on its commitment to open government.
European News Bulletin.
Thank you for being with us. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. Now we begin with our top story. Because Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has given evidence in an investigation into her handling of sexual harassment allegations against her predecessor Alex Salmond. Once the duo leading the fight for Scottish independence, they're now embroiled in a scandal that could derail efforts to break away from the United Kingdom. In this report, Bianca Rahimi fills us in.
The
raise your right hand, First Minister, and repeat after me.
This is the moment Nicola Sturgeon has been waiting for, the chance to prove she did not plot to bring down her former mentor. She is accused of botching an investigation into sexual harassment charges against her predecessor, Alex Salmond, holding key meetings in her home regarding the complaints, breaking the ministerial code and repeatedly lying to Parliament. Amid calls to resign, she faced a committee of the Scottish Parliament Wednesday and reiterated her position.
A number of women made serious complaints about Alex Salmond's behaviour. The government, despite the mistake it undoubtedly made, tried to do the right thing. As First Minister, I refused to follow the age-old pattern of allowing a powerful man to use his status and connections to get what he wants. The police conducted an independent criminal investigation. The Crown Office, as it does in prosecutions every single day of the week, considered the evidence and decided there was a case to answer. A court and a jury did their jobs. And now this committee and an independent investigation are considering what happened and why.
Sturgeon now has a delicate balance to strike as a woman and a politician. She says she didn't know there were alleged concerns about Salmond's sexual behaviour, but later was convinced by Salmond himself that something inappropriate did happen.
And although he denied the allegations, he gave me his account of one of the incidents complained of, which he said he had apologised for at the time. What he described constituted, in my view, deeply inappropriate behaviour on his part. Perhaps another reason why that moment is embedded so strongly in my mind.
Two key witnesses have now provided damning evidence Sturgeon repeatedly misled Parliament, corroborating Alex Salmond's version of events. He gave evidence on the 26th of February and accused the government of withholding documents pertaining to the case and damaging Scotland's reputation.
Some people say that the failures of these institutions, the blurring of the boundaries between party, government and prosecution service, mean that Scotland is in danger of becoming a failed state. I disagree. The Scottish civil servant hasn't failed. Its leadership has failed.
What hangs in the balance here is not just Nicola Sturgeon's career, but her lifelong goal to see an independent Scotland. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has slapped down her demands for a new referendum as irrelevant and unnecessary. Nonetheless, she has vowed to hold a new independence vote if she wins a majority in May's Holyrood elections. However, first she must stave off demands for her to resign and survive a no-confidence vote in Parliament. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And Mick Napier, political commentator in Edinburgh, joins us at the moment. And Mick, are you watching this from behind your fingers as this drama plays itself out? How do you think it's going?
Well, for those of us who support independence, this is a catastrophe. Everyone uses the word botched for the way the government has handled the allegations. We know there was something wrong. Alex Salmond even had to apologise for his inappropriate behaviour towards women to whom he was senior, and there's not much of a way back from that in this period after Me Too. And there's also issues of the Lord Advocate being too close to the... I mean, there's a constitutional issue here that he sits in the Cabinet and he's not altogether the impartial legal expert that he should be. So, I mean, the government was found guilty of bias. It's not an allegation of bias. They were found the whole investigation into Salmond was tainted with bias, and it was resisting that conclusion that led the government to squander £600,000. This is a small country. That's a lot of money, and we now see that although Alex Salmond should have been vulnerable to allegations of inappropriate behaviour, He went in front of a jury of 8 women and 5 men, and every single charge was thrown out. Those members of the jury must have been influenced, but not in the jury room. They must have been influenced by allegations of a kind of conspiracy. Indeed. And we saw the documents that were forced to be released by the Scottish government. They dug in to prevent certain documents being released, and it was only the threat of a no-confidence vote on the Deputy First Minister that forced some of them to be handed over to the parliamentary committee.
Of course, Mick, but now with this, I guess the real question here is Westminster's clutching its hands together in glee. How harmful has this been for the future of Scotland's independence movement?
There were 22 public opinion polls in a row, each of them showing either the same or an increasing majority for independence. The 23rd poll commissioned recently amidst this huge fight inside, but between the two most popular and high-profile politicians in Britain over decades, has shown that the majority has disappeared. To get independence, to get the majority, to get it over the line, even starting off with 58% majority, would be a huge effort. And the SNP is viewed by many of its members even, including MPs, as purely an instrument for achieving independence, after which they would decamp to some other political formation. So for independence-minded individuals in Scots, and that's the majority, it really is a disaster. Who benefits? Johnson. Those people who wish to maintain the integrity of the United Kingdom.
Indeed. Mick, we're going to continue to watch this one because I dare say it will play on and on, especially as we lead up into May. Thank you. Now, the United States has imposed sanctions on several Russian officials and on more than a dozen businesses over the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington announced earlier today that sanctions were an attempt to send a clear signal to the Russians regarding their behavior, adding that the move was in conjunction with the European Union's announcements of penalties levied on other individuals accused of the same allegations. Now, Moscow has strongly denied any wrongdoing and warned Washington to, quote, not play with fire, adding that the U.S. must not lecture other nations on human rights, as the North American country is itself a serious violator of international peace treaties and has a history of human rights abuses. Well, in the past couple of hours, British Chancellor Rishi Sunak has announced his second budget, a year after he took the job and a month before coronavirus upended Britain's economy. Well, we're going to cross to Sai Poreza, who's outside Britain's Parliament for us, with his highlights of the Chancellor's announcements. It's wet, it's rainy, Saeed, but what were the highlights for you?
We were hoping for the rain to let up, but still to do that. As you say, the Chancellor came up with that announcement in the early hours of this afternoon in the House of Commons. He started out by telling the British public the huge amount of money that the government has spent on the COVID response. He went on to reiterate that his top priority is to keep jobs and to protect British livelihoods. And to do so, he went on to say that the furlough scheme, the job retention scheme, so-called, that has helped keep in employment some 11 million people over the past year, will be extended until September, the end of summer. He also mentioned that the support for the unemployed will still be extended till the end of September. He also went on to say that the so-called stamp duty holiday. Stamp duty is the tax that you pay to the government when you buy a property. That it'll also be extended till June. Also, the so-called mortgage guarantee scheme, whereby if you're a first-time home buyer, you pay 5% upfront, and the government underwrites the 95% that you will take in the form of a mortgage or home loan from a financial institution. Plus the $1.6 billion more to be injected into the vaccination rollout, as we know, is in full swing in this country at the moment, and a whole host of other issues for which funding has been announced, including how to tackle the climate emergency.
Indeed, but then, how was this received, and why is he doing and taking some of the measures that he is at the moment?
Well, I can tell you, the people up in Washington, this is the critics, the opposition, they weren't complimentary at all. In fact, we heard from the leader of the Labour Party, the opposition Labour Party, Sarah Keir Starmer, saying for things like it is hard to put a positive spin looking at this, looking at the decisions of the past year and the neglect, in his words, of the past 10 years, taking a jab at the conservative governments that have been in power over the past decade. He went on to say that this budget simply papers over the cracks and that it only defers the problem. He brought up the issue of the more than 4 million Brits who now live in poverty among children. And the decisions that this government has taken since the pandemic struck, which, for example, was the government ignoring the so-called circuit breaker called for by the opposition and scientists to bring down the reproduction.
All right, Saeed Poreza for us in a wet, rainy London. Thank you very much. Now we move to some developing news because the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has launched a formal inquiry into Israel's war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now, Fatou Bensouda said it will be conducted independently, impartially, and objectively without fear or favor. In 2019, Bensouda said there was a reasonable basis to open a war crimes probe into Israeli military actions in the Gaza Strip, which killed thousands in 2014 alone, as well as Israeli settlement activity in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Authority and Hamas have welcomed the investigation, but Tel Aviv strongly opposes it. Now, three men and a woman have pleaded not guilty to a charge of criminal damage over their alleged role in the toppling of a statue erected to honor 17th century slave trader Edward Colston. The monument was toppled last year and pushed into UK town's Bristol's harbor after global anti-racism protests began following the killing of the American black man George Floyd by police officers. The toppling of the statue led to other memorials of controversial figures in the UK being pulled down and kick-started debates over the UK's colonial legacy. The official trial of the Colston Four is set to begin on December the 13th and is expected to last several days. Well, Richard Sudan is going to be with us shortly, just awaiting his arrival on our social media section.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
There you are, Richard. Wondered what had happened to you for a brief moment there, but bring us up to speed. We're talking Meghan and Harry.
So, yes, Amina, it's very interesting watching this drama play out because Meghan Markle is being attacked by the UK media yet again. But what's interesting is a lot of people are actually saying that whatever your opinion of the UK royal family might be, whichever side you're on, a lot of people are saying that, look, here's Meghan Markle, a black woman who married into the royal family. The royal family is arguably the most powerful, privileged white family possibly in recorded human history. That wealth was accumulated by the plunder of countries of black people and non-white people. And you have Prince Andrew born into this family with allegations that he's potentially linked to possibly the most wide-reaching sex scandal in history, led by Jeffrey Epstein, and yet people are saying there's a disproportionate focus on Meghan Markle by the media, and some are suggesting this kind of melee might actually tell us as much about the UK state as indeed the history of the monarchy. Of course, you know, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have been in the press for a while now, but, you know, this is the fundamental point really being made here. People are saying this is shifting focus away from Prince Andrew, who many think, many are arguing, should be part of a criminal inquiry or at least should be questioned by the authorities. But, of course, he's not. And so, you know, inevitably, Amina, this has created a firestorm online, which is brewing and it's been there for a while now.
Just give me two of your favoured tweets, Rich.
Got to go to the commentator James O'Brien first, who says if an independent inquiry finds that Meghan Markle bullied staff members, she should be sacked as Home Secretary immediately. Now, this, of course, is a nod to Priti Patel, who faced the Home Secretary, who faced very real accusations of bullying. And let's go to Femi, on Twitter, who says, according to the UK press, Meghan Markle can not only cause droughts and murder her with brunches, but she can chop up journalists with her jewellery. Compared to her, what's a child sex trafficking ring between mates? Am I right? A very tongue-in-cheek satirical comment there from Femi.
All right, we move on to our next story. Equally disturbing in its own way.
Very much so. There's been reports and activists and experts which are saying that the rise in Islamophobia in so-called liberal Canada is being reflected in a number of attacks which have taken place in public spaces against Muslim women wearing the hijab, and within that category, specifically black Muslim women wearing the hijab. There have been at least 5 recorded attacks in recent days, but of course, Amina, those are only the attacks that we know about. And people are basically demanding immediate action on the issue. They want people to feel safe. They want Muslims and Muslim women to be safe and feel safe in the public sphere. But actually, other people are making the point that, look, with Justin Trudeau as Prime Minister, with his checkered history, is any action really going to be taken? Because Justin Trudeau was known for wearing blackface, which is hugely offensive to black people and hugely offensive to anyone who's on, you know, the right side of the anti-racism cause. But this is cause for alarm. I mean, Islamophobia is a global phenomenon, and we're seeing it, you know, rear its head in the streets in Canada, and this is causing massive concern for all those with an eye on the issue.
Indeed. Your top 2 tweets?
Let's go to Sarah Mushtaq, first of all, who says, visibly Muslim women are the most susceptible to hate crimes, with black Muslim women being even more vulnerable, as demonstrated by the last few months. Saying this is not us or things must change is not enough right now and wasn't enough in the past. And let's go to Morelle Andrews, who says, it's International Women's Day 2021 in just a few days. And in Canada, we need to take real action on targeting violence like this. It's disgusting. And many comments are like this online at present, Amina.
It really is. And for all of us concerned, let's hope everyone keeps safe. Thank you very much, Richard. Shifting gears now, because Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has announced that his government is working on a series of measures that will, quote, improve rights and freedoms in the country. In a televised address, the Turkish leader stated that the new measures to be implemented over the next 2 years would include improved press freedoms and freedoms of expression, as well as attempts to reduce violence against women. During his statement, Erdogan declared that the measures were also an attempt to improve negotiations with Brussels over the attachment of Turkey to the EU. His comments come months after the European Union slammed limited sanctions on Ankara over the dispute in the eastern Mediterranean concerning hydrocarbon exploration disagreements with Greece. Disturbing news coming out of Myanmar, Ahmed Kabalo.
Yes, the violence against the anti-coup protesters doesn't seem to be going away, as more are critically injured, as more videos are emerging on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, of the army and the police cracking down on protesters. We can see health workers and health volunteers being attacked by the police, protesters being attacked, shots being fired. We've got a tweet from Tom King, who says, Myanmar is becoming a one-sided war zone. The police and the military are arresting protesters en masse, and brutality and indiscriminately torturing and killing civilians. Lack of action from international community is astounding. Urgent action must be taken. Now, there is another side to this story that some are keen to voice on social media, and that this violence isn't new to Myanmar, but it had been previously dished out to the Rohingya community in the Rakhine state. And it was supported, that violence was supported by the National League of Democracy, the party of Aung San Suu Kyi and her supporters. And now that violence is coming back to haunt them. And we've got a tweet from Ashok, who says, in 2017, when Myanmar army attacked the Rohingya, those who kept quiet or sided with the barbarity are now facing the wrath of the criminal force. It is thus an important to raise your voice when others are attacked. Don't wait till they come after you. And this is a lesson that many people in Sudan also learn. because when the violence was being dished out in Darfur and the Nuba Mountains, many Sudanese people ignored it until it came to the streets of Khartoum, Omdurman and Bahrain. Now, Kenneth Roth, who is the executive director of Human Rights Watch, who's not always right on these topics, but he's right on this point, he says videos show Myanmar soldiers and police officers using shotguns, flashbangs, tear gas grenade launchers and rifles to attack anti-coup protesters. At least one of the unit involved in the crackdown had been implicated in atrocities against the Rohingya Muslims.
Strong points to move on to our second story, Ahmed.
Yeah, this is a story that will shock many people, particularly because we are in 2021. And that is Pontins, which is a British holiday residence, used a blacklist of common Irish names to keep traveller families out of holiday parks. Now, this story is shocked many people online because there was this blacklist of undesirable guests, and who would make the list of undesirable guests would be determined by their surname and if they had an Irish sounding surname such as Boyle, Delaney, Gallagher and so on. And some people are saying this is actually reminds them of the 60s and the 70s in the UK, where you would see signs like no blacks, no Irish, no dogs, and actually reminds them of the mistreatment of Irish people that dates back to the 16th century, with Ireland being Britain's first colony. And some people argue that Ireland is still a colony of the UK because the UK continues to occupy the six counties known as Northern Ireland. Now, Howard Beckett says, as a proud Irishman, this repulses me to my core. There can be no place for anti-Irish racism in society. Martin says, generally gobsmacked by the racism discrimination shown by Pontins, refusing cancelling bookings based on people's names. It seems like something from the 1950s. Shameful. Well done, whichever staff member blew the whistle. And final tweet on this, Chris says, absolutely vile and disgusting behaviour by Pontins. I would say I'll never go there again due to this behaviour, but having visited Pontins once, I'll never go there again because of how bloody awful the place was.
Ouch, that's got to hurt. I mean, it's one thing to be accused of clear, rampant racism, but it's quite another to have your breakfast questioned in such obvious terms. All right, Ahmed Cavallo, we're going to leave it there for the moment. Thank you. And we're going to leave you for the time being as well. So thank you so much for sticking with this broadcast. Until next time, stay safe.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Hope about the future and about achievements in economic, cultural, political, and military areas. The third point about corona is that the people should continue to observe health protocols. These days, we are having fewer casualties. Of course, the figures are still high. 100 plus deaths in 24 hours is not a low figure. Rather, it is too high. Nonetheless, the death rates have dropped a little compared to previous days. But the people should not think that the issue is over, because this is not the case. They should continue to observe the protocols. Those officials who have responsibilities in this regard should carry out their duties as well. The fourth point about corona is that some people have gained good experience in this regard. For example, they have developed certain medicines and they have tested it under the supervision of certain officials, and they have endorsed them as efficient. Therefore, they should not face opposition. There are many individuals in different corners of the country who might do something new. Of course, this does not mean that officials should accept every claim, but they should examine and study them carefully at least. My last word to our dear nation, to the dear people of Qom, and to its esteemed Islamic seminary, is that the Iranian nation managed to conduct a great revolution in the past in the shade of unity, firm determination, piety, timely presence, and diligence. It managed to carry out the great feat which changed the course of the history of the world and humanity. Today, the same nation is present with the same capabilities. With more experiences and with resources several times larger than those days, and therefore, it can overcome all obstacles.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Our nation can achieve success in economic areas, in the area of production, in the area of the value of national currency, in the area of cultural matters, and in political, military, and other such areas. I hope that God will increase His blessings and His grace on this nation on a daily basis, God willing. God's greetings be upon His great Wali, the great Imam of the age, Hujjat ibn al-Hasan. May our souls be sacrificed for His sake, whose assistance has always been a source of support for us. And God's mercy and greetings be upon the immaculate and blessed soul of our magnanimous Imam who opened this path for us. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah, 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 Alhamdulillah.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing The House on Cocoa Road, directed by Damani Baker. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Telegraph, The Guardian, and many others. And alongside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, The House on Cocoa Road is the story of director Damani Baker's family, particularly about his mother's story, Fanny Houghton, who moved her children from Oakland, California, to participate in the Grenada Revolution, only to find her family in harm's way of a U.S. military invasion. This film also sheds light on the history of black power movements and their struggle for racial equality.
I call the United States home, but this country has a painful legacy of violence that we still struggle to confront.
I think we always have to find something that holds a promise, and that way we look toward the future.
You're committed to humanity, to making the world a better place. You know, not just for your family, but everybody's family. We were trying to make sense of this world.
One of the most important things that has to be done in the process of carrying out a revolutionary struggle is to merge the personal with the political, where they're no longer separate.
You have this situation where we are trying to build a new society.
Grenada is the southernmost of the Windward Islands in the West Indies.
Here's our revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was a utopia.
And the next thing I knew, she was packing you all up.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet-Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy.
I took my young children out of my country to come here to help this country. I left in pain. This is the first time I've been back, so you've got to be very sensitive.
I remember you asking me, as the bombs dropped and the island shook, you said, this must be what they call war.
There is a freedom tide rising in our hemisphere. The spirit of democracy is assuming its rightful role as the great unifier of the people.
They're shooting! They're shooting!
My mother always said that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And if we work towards change, conditions will become different.
Long live peace in our Americas and in the world. Forward ever, backward never.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for joining the show. Now, this documentary gives you an insightful and historical look at race relations in the US and also offers an alternative look at the US-led invasion of Grenada, but from a black perspective. And Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this film?
I think it's a very strong film. It's a very engaging film. I think what it does particularly well, there's a clip very early on where Angela Davis, the great black activist, is saying, we need to make the personal political. And this is exactly what this film does. It starts with this opening montage of footage from various tapes that Damani Baker, the director, has found in, I think, the garage of his mother when he was moving her house, when she was moving house. Yeah, and you know, so you've got footage from, you know, 83, 99, 2015, all spliced together. And you get a sense of a young man, young filmmaker, piecing these disparate frames and images together, trying to work out what they represent. But he does so in a way that's incredibly casual. It doesn't feel like a serious history lesson. It feels like you've been invited over to someone's house on a Sunday morning. They're telling you about their family history over coffee and cake. It's sort of deceptively casual, but it does build to a much bigger picture of American life, and black American life in particular.
And Lee, if I could turn to you now, why is it important